America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot happening at this hour as we speak. Noon Eastern time, 9 Pacific time here across the United States. It is John Edwards is holding a press conference at this moment, or will be shortly, in which the word is that he is going to announce that he is suspending his campaign for the presidential nomination, the Democratic presidential nomination, because his wife's breast cancer has recurred and he wants to be there and available with her and you know, go through that very difficult process of dealing with it with her. And it's, if that's the case, and it, you know, it's being reported by several different sources, including CNN right now, that that's what he's going to be saying in a few moments. It's, you know, I salute him for being with his wife and his family. I mean, all of us, the only possible response, the only human response is, you know, good on you for doing the right thing with your family. And at the same time, you know, what a disappointment for the nation. John Edwards, I think, would have made a tremendous president. Now, the language that they're using is suspend his campaign. That's different than ending his campaign. So let's pay very careful attention to that and see, you know, how long is it suspended, what happens, how it goes. He may even win some primaries without campaigning. I mean, who knows? Most people out there know who John Edwards is. I mean, he ran for vice president 4 years ago. We know who he is. We've seen him. We're familiar with his positions on the issues. And so, I don't know. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this drama plays out. Similarly, speaking of drama, the Senate today, just a few hours ago, authorized subpoenas of Bush's aides. And the one thing that I'm curious about is why nobody has even talked about subpoenaing Bush himself. But I guess again, that's the, you know, the Patrick Fitzgerald technique. You work very slowly. You start at the bottom and you work your way up. The little fish to medium-sized fish, and then the medium-sized fish hopefully turn on the big fish. But the Senate Judiciary Committee, following the lead of the House Judiciary Committee, now has the authority. Now, they haven't issued any subpoenas yet. But basically, Pat Leahy in the Senate now has the authority that John Conyers received yesterday in the House of Representatives to issue subpoenas specifically to Karl Rove, Kyle Sampson, Harriet Myers, and a number of other people in the Alberto Gonzalez, and another number of other people in the White House and the Department of Justice. And what we're going to be watching now is this dance of how this plays out. You know, what is the White House going to do? Tony Snow was on ABC this morning. He's going, they want to have a show trial. I mean, the White House is trying to play this as, oh, it's just all politics. You will recall that was what, those of you who are old enough or those of you who have read history will recall that is the argument that Richard Nixon made. Oh, it's all politics. They're just coming after me because I'm an effective Republican president and I've got an unpopular war. It's all politics. And then we discovered that Nixon was actually in the background secretly wiretapping Democrats. And you look back and you find that George W. Bush now, I mean, there's a bunch of stories that are kind of getting lost in all this news. For example, day before yesterday, a story came out that the FBI has been secretly wiretapping people without subpoenas, without authorization, against the law. We're not talking about the FISA violations. That's the National Security Agency, the NSA. We're not talking about the foreign intelligence security violations. We're talking about the FBI domestically has been basically, you know, breaking into people's electronic homes illegally, in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which is pretty unambiguous about this. I mean, the Fourth Amendment just lays it out quite explicitly. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. And if papers back in that day isn't the equivalent of an email today, I just don't see any other way to interpret it. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. In other words, the only way that they can violate the right of the of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects is if a warrant is issued, and that warrant can only be issued if a judge decides that somebody probably is engaged in committing a crime. And then it continues, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, somebody has to swear before a judge that it's true. Under risk of prosecution for swearing falsely, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, it has to be specific. You can't just say, okay, everybody who showed up at that peace march, go to their homes. No, sorry, you've got to name person by person by person. And you have to say, and here's what we think that they did that is illegal. And a judge has to look at that and say, you know, it looks to me like there actually may be a crime committed here. Go for it. I mean, that's at the very minimum, that is the threshold of proof. So here you have the Justice Department out there breaking into people's houses electronically and perhaps physically. Let's not forget that the Patriot Act says that police can break into your home right now without a warrant. You do sneak and peek searches as long as they don't notify you, as long as you never know about it, and as long as they don't disturb your home. And so, there are so many violations of the Constitution and arguably violations of the law. And on top of that, you have this whole Lawyergate thing. I mean, these federal prosecutors who were fired because they were poor performers. Right. USA Today. I believe this is on the front page. Three fired prosecutors were in top 10 for convictions, federal data show. Paul Charlton in Arizona, David Iglesias in New Mexico, Carol Lamb in California. These three of the fired prosecutors were among the top 10 in terms of convictions per 100 million residents out of the 93 prosecutors. Oh, but they weren't doing a very good job, so we just had to fire them. No, they were either prosecuting Republicans or saying when they were presented with a request that they prosecute Democrats, they looked at the evidence and they said, doesn't look like there's a crime here. Doesn't look like there's a case here. And then the administration says, well, it wasn't that they were doing their jobs badly, it's that they weren't prosecuting the right thing. We wanted them to prosecute immigration cases. Okay, the number one guy in the United States, Paul Charlton, the number one prosecutor in terms of convictions per 100,000 people or per million people or whatever it is, per 100 million residents. Number one guy in Arizona, Charlton filed 9,565 immigration cases in 2006, up from 2,234 4 years earlier. I mean, he wasn't just doing his job with regard to immigration. He was kicking butt. In Arkansas, where Cummins was dismissed, there were gains in virtually every major criminal offense category during the past 5 years. These guys were aggressive Republican prosecutors, and that's the problem, is that today's Republican Party, and in particular this administration, they don't want honest prosecutors, regardless of their party affiliation. Adam Cohen today in the New York Times, brilliant editorial, where he just lays it out. This is the U.S. Code, 18 U.S. Code 1501 to 1520, is the federal obstruction of justice statute. And he lays it out. He says, you know, that, you know, it's clear, it's fairly clear that this has been violated. And he goes through and he lays out the specifics. Number one, misrepresentations to Congress. This is U.S. Code 1505, Section 18. He says it's illegal to lie to Congress and also to impede it in getting information. Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty indicated to Congress that the White House involvement in U.S. attorneys, in firing U.S. attorneys, was minimal, something that Justice Department emails suggest to be untrue. And yet Gonzalez went before Congress and said, I would never, ever make a change in any United States attorney position for political reasons. And now we find out that that's not the case. And then they do this document dump that's got this suspicious 16 to 18 day gap in it. And then on top of that, we find out that Bush doesn't, the document gap is almost entirely emails, but Bush doesn't use email. Gonzalez doesn't use email. Harriet Meyer says she doesn't use email. Secretary of State Condi Rice says she doesn't use email. Rumsfeld didn't use email. And Chertoff says he doesn't use email. So where are the documents, Charlie? 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Oh, we'd like to, George.
I can't serve you anymore. Oh, oh, oh. I've done all the damage I can do. There's only one more thing I can do for you.
And what might that be, George?
I'll be your sacrificial lamb.
Ah, yes, just what we need.
Serve me up with mint jelly and a side of ham.
Hello, I'm Sharon Taslow. We're interrupting programming to bring you a live news conference.
Cheney, too. For once, I'll just tell him what to do.
Ah, yes.
Let's let the world know I atone.
Well, Jim Turr is the author of that, by the way. It's from BlueCanyonSatire.com. Thanks a lot, Julian. We'll wrap that up. It's Please Impeach Me. And, you know, if George Bush had anything to do with this, with these prosecutors, then perhaps he should be. I believe John Edwards is speaking right now.
Monday of this week, Elizabeth went to the doctor because she felt a pain on her left side. She went in, had x-rays taken. The result of the x-rays showed that she may have a fracture on the left side, and there was also something that looked suspicious in a rib on the right side. I was in Iowa at the time. She was called on Tuesday. I was in Iowa at the time. She called me and said that they wanted to do follow-up tests yesterday on Wednesday. So I came back from Iowa on Tuesday night. Wednesday, we went into the hospital here at Chapel Hill. Had further tests done. A bone study was done. That study actually made the suspicion about the rib on the right side more intense. There was more concern about it. And as a result, there was a biopsy done of that section of her rib on the right side. The biopsy showed that the cancer had returned. It was malignant. And later in the day, we did a CT scan, which was done for the purpose of basically examining the soft tissue. The bone study had looked at her hard tissue. The CT scan showed very little. And so the net result of all the tests is that her cancer is back. It's largely confined in bone, which is a good thing. Dr. Carey, who's actually seated on the front row here, Dr. Lisa Carey, who's in charge of Elizabeth's care, will be available to answer questions from you when we finish. If you have medical questions, technical questions, but the bottom line is her cancer is back. We are very optimistic about this because having been through some struggles together in the past. We know that the key is to keep your head up and keep moving and be strong. We intend to do exactly that. Although when the cancer goes from breast and shows in bone, which it's doing now, it's no longer curable. It is completely treatable. And there, I'll let Dr. Carey speak to this later, but she indicated to us that because of the relatively minimal
presence of cancer in other places because of the size, the relatively small size of the tumor, that that we, she and we, as a result, are very, very optimistic. And many patients in similar circumstances have lived many years undergoing treatment. The thing that is true is that her cancer will not be cured now. Elizabeth will have this as long as she's alive, and the analogy that that Dr. Carey gave us is it's like a patient having diabetes. You know, the disease never goes away, the diabetes never goes away, but you treat it with insulin, you take your medicine, and that's exactly what we intend to do. And I intend to do the same thing I've always done with Elizabeth. We've been married 30 years, known each other longer than that, and we will be in this every step of the way together.
This is John Edwards speaking right now. It's live breast cancer conference or conference about his wife's, the return of his wife's breast cancer, and apparently he's now turned it over to his wife to talk, and you know they're confining their comments so far to the cancer. The understanding that we have from news reports that we've seen, varying from CNN to the New York Times, is that in a few moments he's going to continue to announce that he will be suspending his campaign for the presidency. And, you know, if that's the case, and it would certainly, given this kind of diagnosis, which is far more severe, frankly, far more troubling than just, you know, the breast cancer itself, that it's moved, something that, well, you can just see where, you know, he would say, okay, that's it, I'm going to be here with my wife. And it's a shame for the Democratic Party, and it speaks so highly of John Edwards as a man and as a human being, and as why he would make, frankly, such a good president. What an ironic situation. What a tragic situation. And please keep them both in your prayers. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with your calls after this break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the True People's Radio. Now I'm contradicting myself. This is what happens when you're doing the reports on the fly. CNN now is reporting former North Carolina Senator John Edwards says today his presidential campaign will go on. That he and his wife have talked about it, and they've decided to move this thing ahead.
That happened.
Actually,
that
I was beating her.
Yeah.
It's actually still going on. They're having a conversation right now, and America is probably glued to their TVs as we speak. But it's so if we'll find out. We'll find out, you know, how this all wraps up. Ian in San Francisco, California. Hey, Ian, welcome to the program.
Welcome, Tom. Yeah. Hey, I just wanted to say one thing. You know, we can only imagine how Gingrich would have handled this news today that Edwards received. With his divorce papers in hand.
Right. Well, he already did that. So
yeah, Mr. Family, the Family Values Party come with divorce papers when they find out their wives have cancer.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was after she was treated for cancer, but the effect is the same. She was recovering from the, she was coming out of anesthesia, apparently, when he presented the divorce papers to her.
Hey, Tom, let me ask you a question.
Now, was that his high school math teacher that he had married, or was that his second wife that he divorced that way? Because his high school math teacher was his first wife.
You know, I don't know the whole history of his wife, but from what I can tell, the candidates for president on the Republican side, the only goal they have in mind is to somehow catch up with Henry VIII.
Yeah, okay.
That's
all right, yeah. And we'll just leave it at that, because I generally don't like to get into personal stuff. I just don't, you know, I'd rather talk about the issues anyway. So,
same here.
You had an issues comment or question you wanted to make as well.
On the matter of impeachment?
Yeah.
What I'd say this is this, and it goes in with that little song you played. I just heard it today. It was great, about Please Impeach Me.
Yeah.
I think we've had the kind of the side, and I've been on this side too, the angry impeachment, where we're just angry about what Bush has done. We want to impeach him, and it's illegal what he's done and everything. But what about a concept of a compassionate impeachment? In other words,
yes,
for his sake.
Yeah, you know, actually, there's something to be said for that, and for the nation's sake.
Well, yeah.
But, yeah.
And, you know, he could still have his library. We tell him he could still have a library. And, like, mm-hmm. Karl Rove could be, like, the chief librarian. And Myers, she could kind of like maybe be assistant librarian.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Gonzalez library. Could like handle the reference decks, you know, on any subject related to torture.
Sure. And bring Rumsfeld in to talk about, you know, how to have a successful war. And
exactly.
Yeah, they could have a library.
But,
yeah, it could be very entertaining. Ian, thanks a lot for the call and for the great idea. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Tomas, what's on your mind today?
You're an awesome liberal, brother, let me tell you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I just want you to give me the numbers on how many lawyers Bush let go in 2000. Did he let them all go like the other presidents did?
Well, first of all, firing the attorneys when you come into office is really the wrong way to say it. With all presidential appointments, with all people who are political appointees, typically, when an administration changes, whether it's at the federal level or at the state level, when the administration changes, you're expected to submit your letter of resignation.
Right.
You turn that thing in. And the letter of recommendation either gets accepted or not. And so it's not that the president comes in and he fires all the lawyers. It's that all the lawyers resign and he accepts their resignation or not. Then he appoints for those that he accepts the resignation of, and my understanding is that Bush accepted the resignation of all 93, although I may be wrong on that. I haven't seen anything to contradict that. I believe that to be the case.
Okay.
And I'd be
all
surprised
right.
if it was anything other than that. And then he appoints people of his own choice, and they have to be confirmed by the Senate so that there is, you know, both branches of government have an opportunity to take a look at what ends up being the third branch of government, or will be before the third, interacting with the third branch of government, which is the judiciary, even though these prosecutors are working for the executive. And throughout the history of the United States, we have never seen federal attorneys fired for anything other than for wrongdoing. There's been about 10 of them total who've actually been fired after, you know, after that process of resigning and being appointed and being confirmed has gone through. And in every single one of those cases, it was, I mean, you know, like one guy beat somebody up in a bar. Another guy got, you know, was accused of spousal abuse. I mean, there were a couple of convictions where, you know, I mean, looking back over the history of the last 100 years or so. And it's just never before been, we're going to fire you because you didn't prosecute enough Democrats or because you're looking into, you know, Jerry Lewis having committed a crime.
All right. Well, hey, great answer. And, you know, there's nobody out there, brother, that will take on the opposition, you know, quality opposition like you. And I'm telling you, you know, I'm opposed to your political views, but I do believe the country would be served better if you ran for a Senate or a House, because you are one of a kind, bro.
Well, thank you, Tomas. And as a good conservative, I appreciate all the years you've been listening and calling into this program and keeping up the other side of it. And I can guarantee you right now, I assure you, I will never, ever run for political office. You don't have to worry about that. Jillian, in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Jillian, welcome.
Jillian, I just watched John Edwards' press conference.
Mm-hmm.
They are the
it's
most.
It's still going on, actually.
Pardon me?
It's still going on.
Well,
yeah.
I had to call because my husband and I are going through prostate cancer, and They are the most incredible couple, and what she said is so important for people to hear. It's a manageable thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are incredible.
Yeah.
I keep saying that, but I don't think this is any detriment to their campaign. I think it's an asset.
Yeah.
Who
yeah,
would you well, rather have, the coddled man in the White House right now or this man?
Yeah, no, I have already sent $100 to the John Edwards campaign. I'll
I'm going to send one too, Tom, because they need it. And I saw John Edwards in Phoenix probably about a couple of years ago, and he was on the campaign for increasing the minimum wage.
Mm.
He is one good man.
Yeah.
And he has a good wife.
I absolutely agree with you, Jillian, and thank you very much for calling in and putting your vote in there. This is the official announcement now, the CNN's political ticker. Edwards to continue his 2008 candidacy. Former Senator John Edwards announced Thursday he has no plans to suspend his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination due to his wife's recurrence of cancer. The campaign goes on, he said, contradicting earlier media reports, including on this program, where I was quoting CNN. He said, you can go cower in the corner and hide, or you can go out there and stand up for what you believe in. We have no intentions of cowering in the corner. So, you know, that's frankly great news. For me, it's, and I think for all Americans and for the democratic process, whether John Edwards is the Democratic nominee or not, and my hope is that he will be. I think he would make a great president, and we'll see how this all plays out. Alan in Arlington, Texas. Hey, Alan, welcome to AMC or welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, Tom, I just had a about the prosecutor firings. My comment would be, you know, I guess you could call this the obstruction of justice department.
Yeah.
But my question is, you had mentioned that there was an article, I think it was New York Times, that kind of laid
yeah.
out the case. You know,
by Adam Cohen, yeah.
The meme that we hear from the right wingers is that you know, the prosecutors serve at the president's pleasure, and that may not be you know, they're there. It's not right that they do this, but there may not be anything illegal about it. You know, could you just kind of expound on precisely, specifically, what you think they might be able to at least tag, remove,
sure.
and
admire? Here's how they can nail these guys. There is nothing illegal, as far as I can tell, from saying to a political appointee of any stripe, including a federal prosecutor, you're out of here because we've decided you're out of here. That's not against the law. But there are very clear laws against impeding or interfering with or, you know, messing with in any way. I don't have the exact legal language in front of me. Any kind of a federal investigation or prosecution. And so if these guys were fired because they were prosecuting something or because they were refusing to prosecute something that should have been prosecuted, in the case of, whatever it may be. I mean, because there are actually the other half of this is people who are kept in these positions because they were refusing to prosecute Republicans. I think that needs to be looked into just as much. But if the president fired these guys, these people, there's a couple of women in here, because of an investigation, then that becomes a crime. That becomes a specific violation of U.S. Code. Section 18, 1501 through 1520, it's federal obstruction of justice. So, does that make sense?
You know, let me ask you this. I mean, would we have gotten Nixon without the tapes? Because it's going to come down to what can you prove, like with anything
yeah.
else. I mean,
well,
that's
a very good question, and probably not, because it was when Nixon was forced to release the tapes by the Supreme Court that everybody could hear that he had clearly participated in the crime, that he had been a co-conspirator. And at that point, Barry Goldwater, of all people, took Nixon aside and said, it's time for you to step down, Charlie. That's it. Or Richard. Out. You're out. And it's very interesting that all of these senior officials refuse to use email. It's like they don't want a paper trail. This is like the Corleone family. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
right, welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGrounds.com, SmallDog.com, Eco Wine, 1-888-Eco-Wine, Purina One Natural Blends, 866-380-MEOW. Our sponsors nationally. Listen to your local station for your local sponsors as well, and let them know that you're listening. Let them know that you're patronizing their products, and tell your friends about them, because that's what keeps this kind of radio, well, really all kinds of radio, ultimately, on the air. Listener-supported radio. Here, the Tom Hartman radio program. Adam Cohen laying this out in the New York Times today, calling the prosecutors. This is what Heather Wilson and Pete Domenici did in New Orleans, New Mexico. This is flat out against the law. 18 U.S.C. 1512, paragraph C. This is part of the Sarbanes-Oxley reforms, if I'm reading Adam Cohen's piece right in the New York Times. Says that anyone who corruptly obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so is guilty of a crime. Witness tampering makes it, this is a USC 1512, makes it illegal to intimidate congressional witnesses. Michael, this from Adam Cohen's piece in the New York Times today. Michael Elston, Mr. McNulty's chief of staff, contacted one of the fired attorneys, H.E. Cummings, and suggested, according to Mr. Cummings, that if he kept speaking out, there would be retaliation. Mr. Cummings took the call as a threat and sent an email message to other fired prosecutors warning them of it. Several of them told Congress that if Mr. Elston had placed a similar call to one of their witnesses in a criminal case, they would have opened an investigation of it. And therefore, presumably, Congress should too, in my opinion. Number four, this is Adam Cohen again, firing the attorneys. You cannot fire an attorney, as Section 1512 says, to obstruct, influence, or impede an official proceeding. I mean, that's the bottom line here. It looks like the White House has committed numerous, multiple federal crimes. And Congress has the job of overseeing that, and they're trying to oversee that, and the White House is saying, no, we're not going to talk with you. We're not going to talk with you. Sorry. John in Santa Clara. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. First of all, I've got a copy of Ultimate Sacrifice, and I was reading The Dust Jacket. Congratulations, kudos on the book, and the accolade from Gore Vidal, one of my favorite writers. And
yeah, thank you. It was amazing when I got I don't know if you've seen it, if you've read his new autobiography. The entire last chapter of his autobiography is mostly about our book, and mm-hmm. It's like to see your own name in Gore Vidal's autobiography is a shocking thing. I got to tell you, it's a wonderful thing.
I'm on my way to pick that up actually later. I love your show. It reminds me of, quite frankly, I'm 52 in June of like the, quite frankly, like the University of Michigan SDS kind of. I don't know if you want to be associated with that, but that's what it kind of you remind me of. And
I was there with SDS in East Lansing, so I guess we were competing SDSs. Blue versus green. versus green.
I won't keep you. I love your show. I would just mention a couple of things for the record. There's been some kind of wild calls, but I know you're because I'm reading your book, and it's incredible. You annotated and then a footnote. First of all. They said to mention things that out of this dump, you know, if you comb through the dump, well, I got something here. I don't know if it's a four alarm, but I got something for you guys. And on page 26 of part of the dump, and this is at www.fas, that's frankandrewsam.org, you can reference the report. On page 26, President Nixon says chilling words, just like Bush, they co-mingle. Bush, I believe it was on Tuesday at his little thrown together news conference, if you recall that, mentioned, here it is. I gotta get it out of my, he mentioned, executive and separation of powers. That jumped out of the page. I said, I gotta call Tom's show because, this is incredible.
No, this is the argument that that Bush is making right now is the same argument that Nixon made, which is that there is this separation of powers. And in fact, the phrase separation of powers does not appear in the Constitution, although there is, you know, there are separate responsibilities and there are separate powers. I mean, it's sort of a granted thing, but there is also the requirement for oversight of government functions. Congress makes the laws. The executive branch is charged with following them and executing them, making sure that they're followed. And if they're breaking the law or if they're failing to prosecute the laws, then they need to be held accountable. And one form of accountability is impeachment. John, thanks for the call. You know, well said. Bill in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Oh, well, basically all your points about obstruction of justice and all that, I don't think that's even half of the issue here. And if
what's the other half?
Well, if you'll confirm these points for me, I think you'll know where I'm going with this. Which Republican senator's office did the provision come from that would allow Bush?
It was out of Spector's office.
Spector's office. Okay.
Although Alan Spector claims that he didn't have any knowledge of it, that it was
done by
a right-wing appointee that he was forced to take while he was taking chemotherapy by the White House to prove his loyalty because he was questioning the legality of the FISA violated wiretaps.
Right. This is exactly where I'm going with this. Is it not true that the aide who added the provision from his office, and as you said he was unaware of it, is it not true that that person was given a federal prosecutor position?
I don't know.
Did I hear that?
You didn't hear it on this program, or if you did,
I thought I heard it somewhere in Air America that the person from that office who added the provision, unbeknownst to that senator, was given the position for which the bill provided. And what that tells
I'll have to look into that. That's a big deal.
What it sounds like to me is we have a situation here where Bush, either directly or indirectly, went to this guy and said, if you sneak this in, I will make you a federal prosecutor, which means Bush himself has illegally and unconstitutionally legislated the law.
Yeah, well, the executive branch has the ability to try to influence legislation. What they don't have the ability to do is bribe people. That's essentially what you're talking about, is bribery. And, boy, thank you, Bill, for the heads up on that. What tangled webs we weave, eh? It gets just stranger and stranger. So here in the New York Times today, Adam Cohen just laying this out. Misrepresentation to Congress, calling the prosecutors, witness tampering, firing the attorneys, all federal crimes. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Chris Winston is on the line with us. She is the co-author, along with Myrna Blythe, of a new book, How to Raise an American, 1776 Fun and Easy Tools, Tips, and Activities to Help Your Child Love This Country. Chris Winston, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on our program. Looking through your book, I notice, first of all, I just want to say there are some points in here that I think are really well made. For example, the 2006 Scholastic magazine poll that showed that 80% of our kids don't want to grow up to be president. And whereas if you go back to the 1950s, most kids held up as their primary role models Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Dwight Eisenhower. And now, what I didn't see you point out is that what most kids said that they do want to become is Bill Gates. I'm curious if you view that as something we should be concerned about.
Well, I am concerned that children don't aspire to the presidency. When I was a kid, that was one of the things. It was kind of like the part of the American dream that any kid in America could become president. So that's a little disturbing, I think, and one of the reasons poll numbers like that really spurred us to write this book. I don't really have any heartburn over kids wanting to also be like Bill Gates. I mean, he has made a huge mark, not just on this country, but the world. He's a man who's taken his money and is now using it for many wonderful and good projects around the world in terms of AIDS and poverty. So
there was a time, I don't disagree that Bill Gates has done a lot of good stuff with his wealth, but there we're talking with Chris Winston. She, by the way, the first woman to head the White House Office of Speechwriting, serving that position under George Herbert Walker Bush, now heads her own consultancy, Corporate World, which provides strategic communications and writing services for a broad range of clients. The book is published by Random House. howtoraiseanamerican.com is the website. The concern I have about that is that for a long, long time in this country, I would argue, frankly, for most of the history of this country, the American dream was the middle class dream. It was to raise your family, have a decent enough job that with a 40-hour work week you could put your kids through school, you could have vacations, you could have a retirement, you could have a pension, your health care was covered. And somehow in the last 30 years, it seems like the American dream has been reinvented into a lotto type of thing, where the American dream is now to become a millionaire or billionaire, when in, you know, point of fact, fewer than a fraction of 1% of us will ever reach that.
Well, you know, one of the things
I would say this seems to me directly to be a result of the Reagan presidency.
The Reagan presidency?
Yes, yeah. The idea that greed is good, the whole idealization of it, Reagan suspending the Sherman Antitrust Act for all practical purposes, these giant mergers, that was the point. When Reagan came into office, 25% of America had union jobs and 50% of America had the equivalent of a union job. And today it's 7% of our private workforce. I mean, he's the guy who declared war on the American middle class and elevated, you know, ballroom dancing and great wealth as the signs of the presidency, rather than like Jimmy Carter walking like Thomas Jefferson did to the White House for his inaugural.
I have to totally disagree with you in terms of Ronald Reagan, what he did. And I think if you look at polls now and when the President Reagan passed away, the absolute, you know, just swelling support for him that came out across the country, I think would argue that your view of the Reagan presidency may not be quite in tune with most of America these days, who see him as a hero, someone who actually won the Cold War for us, that in fact put in motion, who spent
us into bankruptcy.
Well, there was a Democratic Congress at the time doing the spending, but you know, they agreed on spend, that they would do spending cuts and then never did them. But at the time. But the point here is, I think that.
But Reagan signed every single one of those budgets. I mean, and added $2.5 trillion to our national debt.
And won the Cold War in the process.
Well, won the Cold War. So. Come on, the CIA had been predicting for 20 years that the Soviet Union was going to implode. And by the way, it imploded on George Herbert Walker Bush's watch, not on Ronald Reagan's.
Well, personally, I think Ronald Reagan is a hero, and this country could use more heroes.
Yeah, I get that from reading your book.
Yeah.
You, and in fact, it's appropriately enough in the ballroom of the Ronald Reagan building, one of the nation's most unabashedly patriotic presidents. I think he did a very good job of playing the role of head of state. You know, we have this odd thing in the United States where our head of government is also the head of state, whereas in the United Kingdom, for example, the head of state is the queen. But that as head of government, I think he was a disaster. But that's, you know, a point that we can disagree on, I suppose.
I guess so.
what I'm concerned about is, for example, you're quoting Ben Shapiro, author of Brainwashed, How Universities Indoctrinate Youth. And you say a parent's job is to make sure that they have the right ideas and can defend their kids before they're sent off to college.
Right.
And then you go on to one of your, you know, blaming America. You say even in post 9/11 class discussions, there were teachers in our classrooms who gave more than equal time to America's supposed faults to explain the acts of 19 cowardly terrorists who murdered nearly 3,000 innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you that these were 19 cowardly terrorists and that they murdered 3,000 innocent people. But if we don't know why they did this, aren't we being pretty stupid?
Well, I think most Americans, do understand why they did this. I mean, this is a very radical, extremist group of people. They're religious zealots. They would love to either proselytize us or worse. They would just as soon take over the world. I mean, if you really want to get down to it, they've said as much. They've said they want to kill 4 million Americans, and they won't be satisfied until they do. I mean, there are an endless string of quotes that, and it's very difficult, I think, to try and understand or certainly negotiate with people who are such fanatics, and in this case, religious fanatics.
So the fact of their religious fanaticism being their motive, you believe that that was their primary motivation, just like presumably Tim McVeigh with the Oklahoma City bombing, the other big terrorist of
the United States. I would put him in the fanatic category
as well. Yeah, also a Christian fanatic. But I would submit to you that Tim McVeigh thought that he was going to bring about a revolution in the United States. He was pretty clear about that, the Turner Diaries. And Osama bin Laden said back in 98, it was in the New York Times, that he was going to come after us if we didn't do two things. Number one, take our troops, which were put in there by Bush Sr. in 91, take our troops out of the holy Saudi soil because we had, you know, men drinking alcohol and women driving cars, and it was defiling Saudi Arabia, out of Saudi Arabia, which is something that Bush did just last year. And number two, stopped propping up the Saudi government in a way that was keeping the price of oil low. I mean, Newt Gingrich quotes Osama bin Laden saying that he wanted $200 a barrel oil, and he wanted to the U.S.
And he also
to get
said he wanted
to Saudi
kill
Arabia.
4 million Americans. He also said
as,
that
as a exactly as a consequence of his perception of our occupying his territory. If China had conquered the United States and was occupying the United States, would you be upset with China?
You know, Tom, I just can't find it in myself to take the terrorist side. Can't do it. No can do.
I'm not asking you to.
It sounds like that's what you're asking me to do.
No, not at all.
Really
what I'm saying is I think that your perception of why these guys did this to us is wrong. You're saying that they did it to us because they're religious fanatics, and the world is full of religious fanatics.
In part.
They did it against us because they perceive us as having attacked them first. They're using their religion to justify mass murder as a response. And I think that that's terrible. It's absolutely wrong. It's reprehensible. It's horrible. And it's crazy, frankly, just as it was with Tim McVeigh.
Well, you know what? The Saudi government...
And Tim McVeigh felt attacked.
The Saudi government invited us in. It wasn't... and it isn't... Saudi Arabia does not belong to Osama bin Laden. So, you know, from that standpoint, in terms of sovereignty, we had a perfect right to be there. Now, he may not like it, but a solution of blowing up two buildings and killing 3,000 people, in my view, is not justified under any scenario.
I absolutely agree with you. My point is that we should know why these guys are doing this. And in your book, essentially, you're suggesting we shouldn't even have a discussion about why they're doing it.
No, we didn't say that, but what we do say is we don't think that
you say to have the discussion is to blame America.
So I think that teachers should not be telling children that America is to blame for 9/11. I just don't buy that.
Do you think that what I said a few minutes ago was blaming America?
Yeah, to some degree. You're saying because we were in Saudi Arabia, it was wrong, we shouldn't have been there, and that's
no, I didn't say that. I said because we were in Saudi Arabia, Osama bin Laden felt justified in doing it. I'm not saying that I would feel justified in doing it, or that I think that he was justified in doing it.
Okay, fine, then, you know, that's fine. But all I'm just saying is some teachers, right after 9/11, said, gee, you know, maybe this wouldn't have happened if, you know, we had not irritated Osama bin Laden by...
Chris, we're out of time. I appreciate you being with us. HowToRaiseAnAmerican.com, the website, and the title of the book, Chris Winston, the author, and a great collection of things you can do with your kids. Thank you.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Learn in school today, dear little boy of mine. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free, and that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Indeed. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Karen Tumulty, blogging over at the Time Magazine blog, time-blog.com. This is very interesting. One of our callers pointed this out to me, and thanks to Julian there at Air America who called out a URL for me. Brett Tolman is the guy, and we've reported on him before. I just didn't realize where he had ended up. I mean, this is mind-boggling. Brett Tolman is the guy who was on Arlen Specter's staff, the senior Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee that is about to subpoena people in this whole Attorneygate thing. Brett Tolman was the guy who was on his staff who was put there as a result of right-wing pressure on Specter, who slipped into the Patriot Act the provision that the president could appoint people as federal attorneys, as U.S. federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, without Senate confirmation. Now, in a New York Times piece that was profiling Kyle Sampson, the aide to Alberto Gonzalez, who looks like he may be voluntarily testifying before Congress next week, we'll see. And if so, does that mean that Kyle Sampson is saying, "Okay, that's it. I'm not gonna take a fall for these guys. I am no Scooter Libby. I'll tell you what's good. I don't know who's initiating this. This is all kind of unraveling right now." But Kyle Sampson was, according to this New York Times profile, was in competition for a U.S. attorney post in Utah. And he didn't get the job. Instead, he stayed as assistant to Gonzalez. And who did get that job? Brett Tolman, the guy who worked for Arlen Specter, who slipped this thing into the Patriot Act that made it possible for Brett Tolman to get that job. At least according to Karen Tumulty, Time's national political correspondent since 2001, in the blog over at Time Magazine, time-blog.com. She says, "I'm also intrigued by another connection. According to a New York Times profile of Sampson today, he was in competition himself for a U.S. attorney post in Utah. The name of the guy who beat him out for the job might sound familiar. He was Brett Tolman, who, as I reported in Swampland last week, was the person that Arlen Specter fingered as the Justice Department official responsible for giving the administration its expansive new power to end-run the Senate in appointing U.S. attorneys. It was done under the provision little noticed at the time that was inserted into legislation reauthorizing the Patriot Act. That provision now appears certain to be undone by Congress. And in fact, the Senate voted against it yesterday." And here is from Orrin Hatch's office a news release that David Poole, my producer, just handed to me. "The Senate, by unanimous consent," this is back from July of last year. Now, keep in mind, this provision of the Patriot Act was passed in March of last year, so it just took them a couple of months to get it done. "The Senate, by unanimous consent today, approved Utah Brett Tolman to be the U.S. attorney." Oh, apparently he was actually confirmed by the Senate, according to Orrin Hatch. "Recommended by President Bush, Brett Tolman is the right job for this position, blah, 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 blah. In the Senate, Tolman worked to find an acceptable compromise on the Patriot Act reconciliation and the 2004 DNA bill, blah, 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 blah. Tolman graduated from Brigham Young University." So the plot thickens. We'll see how all this shakes out. Rob in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Rob, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing? Hey, I know you've moved on to talking about the various scandals again, but I just wanted to make a comment about the last guest you had on, the lady there.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the interview, she said, "Well, you know, Ronald Reagan is the one that won the Cold War," and that's always bugged the heck out of me. I was, you know, actually an activist with a lot of people who are of Eastern European descent over here who were supporting dissidents in the East Bloc at that time. And I think we can all remember hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people in Prague and East Germany facing off against their governments. I mean,
yeah. They are the ones who won the Cold War. Arguably, you could also suggest that the Cold War is not over. There are still 10,000 nuclear missiles on each side pointed at each other.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, it's would be a 10-minute comment.
But,
if I could switch gears, though, hey, I got one other comment too, which is I if I'm not getting it wrong here, I've heard you make a couple of comments coming down, I guess, on the side of how Dean. Do you believe that Howard Dean was responsible for the victory in the last election?
I think he was probably largely responsible. Yeah, I don't buy this idea that the moving to the center was the thing and Rahm Emanuel was the guy. I mean, Rahm's running around taking credit for it, but I believe that Howard Dean was principally responsible. Yeah, and
I just wanted to say kudos to you for that, because I mean, it sure looked like Dean was the one who said, "No, I think we can win in the South."
That's right, and the West, and the Midwest.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Dean who was promoting that and the 50-state strategy, and it was Dean who helped get some of the most progressive candidates out there. And where the DCCC, Rahm Emanuel, thanks Rob for the call. Where Rahm Emanuel was, trying to get some of these quote moderate Democrats elected, it was taking piles and piles of money. Whereas when you had the truly progressive candidates, they were getting in fairly easily in many cases. And because, frankly, they're where America's at right now. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. It's like everything and nothing leads to wisdom. It's like no one really meant what they meant. It's like every man's a king, every house a kingdom. It's like Joe McCarthy was an acting president. Everything's A-OK in the USA, in the good old USA. Everything's A-OK.
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. A quote for the day from Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican President of the United States, to announce, he said, that there must be no criticism of the President, or that we are to stand by the President, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, it is morally treasonable to the American public. President Theodore Roosevelt. So who owns patriotism? Somehow Ronald Reagan has been reinvented as this paragon of patriotism. This is patriotism. Well, he did look good on a horse. He did look good in general. I mean, there's a reason why he was a B-movie actor. He didn't look so good with the chimps. But then, you know, when he became president, they bought up all those movies, and you can't find them anymore, by and large. Or it's a little harder. Actually, during his presidency, it was almost impossible. Back in the days of the video stores, before we had the internets. Because I remember looking for them. Where's Bedtime for Bonzo? You can't have it. Somebody bought them all up. Yeah. So who is patriotic in this country? Those people who are trying to reinvent Ronald Reagan as they call him the great communicator. Perhaps, yeah. He was a very good actor. He played the role of head of state very effectively. But as a head of government, he started us down a road that is destroying the American middle class, and that I would argue led in many ways directly to 9/11 as a consequence of our involvement, because Jimmy Carter had successfully begun the process of taking us off our dependence on oil. Jimmy Carter looked at the situation in the Middle East, looked at the situation here in the United States. He was governor of Georgia during the Arab oil boycott or embargo, and saw, you know, what happened, the direct consequence of that. And he said, that's it. We're going to have a national energy policy for this country. I mean, it's crazy not to. And never again are we going to be at the mercy of a bunch of sheikhs in Saudi Arabia for our energy. Never again are we going to have to kowtow to them. Never again are we going to be in a situation where we're basically the hostages of these guys, and we're not going to be fighting wars in that part of the world for oil. I mean, Carter just laid it out, and he put into place all these tax incentives for energy conservation and solar heating and things. He put solar panels on the roof of the White House. I mean, it's not rocket science what Jimmy Carter did. And it worked. There was a decrease in consumption of oil during that time. And he set a very specific goal of saying that by the year 2000, 20% of this nation's energy, electricity, would be coming from solar power. And that we would never again import more oil than we had imported in 1976. Or perhaps it was 78, whichever year it was. He said, that's it. Not going to happen. And he was seriously, truly, really, genuinely, and brilliantly, frankly, taking us down that road. And what happened? Reagan came in as president with all this money from the oil industry, and he said, you know, screw that. and took the solar collectors off the roof of the White House and undid Carter's energy policy, and it became bonanza for big oil. It was bedtime for big oil. And as a consequence, our addiction to oil grew throughout the Reagan presidency and ever since. And thus our involvement in the Middle East, thus we had to protect our oil supplies in Kuwait, and ultimately, thus, as a consequence of that, I would submit to you, that led us right to 9/11. Here's Jimmy Carter, back in 1970.
It's real. The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them.
Well, but Reagan didn't want to face them. He just wanted to ignore them, which is what he did for 8 years.
What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States.
Oh, an energy policy. What a radical idea. You know, Dick Cheney was put in charge of a energy policy task force. Let's create, since Reagan did away with Carter's energy policy, we hadn't had one in all that time, let's create an energy policy. And, of course, they never got around to meeting. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was his counterterrorism task force that never got around to meeting until September of 2001. They were meeting. They were only meeting with oil industry executives. Anyhow, Jimmy Carter.
Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And he had us going down that road successfully in that direction.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
By the year 2000, it puts tears in your eyes, doesn't it? And Reagan undid all that. As I said, in my opinion, that's one of the major things that led right to 9/11, which is not to say that you know, crazies who fly airplanes into buildings should not be held accountable for what they did. Russell in Mississippi. Hey, Russell, welcome to the program.
Hey, wonderful to get to talk to you. Hey, a couple of comments. I was just listening to the Carter thing, you know. Yeah, you know, he was, people want to talk about a moral guy. He's probably the most moral president we've had in a decade. And, you know, he still proves that out, you know, his work with Habitat for Humanity and all his
I'd say he's one of the most moral presidents we've ever had.
Yeah. Compare him to Bush, and the whole smear of things, Reagan, the whole business. I was listening to that earlier. And, you know, the thing about raising an American that's changed is, we have no conscience anymore. That's eliminated, and that's how people like Bush and all his people and his mafia that he's got, they're going to do what they're going to do. They're going to go for power. They're going to go, you know, for the money and control. I mean, you know, it's like Blackwater. We've got a corporate army of mercenaries now that probably, you know, will be used in any corporate endeavor anywhere, including here, at some point in time if we don't get it together and get things going, you know.
Well, yeah, we need to stop this crazed privatization. But, you know, good point, Russell, and thank you for making it. I appreciate the call. Tom in Pittsburgh, and thanks for listening on WSMB, I believe it is. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you. Hey, I'm going to tell you that if Al-Qaeda was really on the ball, what they would have done last summer is allowed George Bush to have some major victories.
Well, I think they tried. I mean, there was that tape of Osama bin Laden that came out just before the election. And, you know, it is some question about whether bin Laden released it or whether Bush released it. But nonetheless,
right,
it came out just before the election. And you know, be afraid, America, be afraid, elect Bush.
That's right. If they had their strategies in order, if they were as wise and as all-seeing as we're told they are, they would have allowed Bush to win some. They would have allowed or encouraged a Republican majority in the House and Senate, and led to the collapse of this country. If we keep going the way we're going, we're in very serious trouble.
Exactly. The bottom line is that George Bush has done exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted. He's let Osama bin Laden go free. And he has and not pursued the people who actually, you know, who were behind the people who did this thing, and has turned the world against us. And that's exactly what bin Laden wanted. Barbara in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Barbara.
Oh, yes. You brought up McVeigh earlier with your last guest.
Yes.
And I don't know. I'm just thinking, was it Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber, considered a terrorist? Well, what was his motive?
Well, I think he was considered a psycho, a person who was mentally ill and was, I believe he was paranoid schizophrenic was the diagnosis when they finally tracked him down, and had perceived grudges against people and was killing them in order to satisfy that. There was some ideology to the Unabomber, apparently, you know, from his writings, anti-corporate ideology, as it were. But I don't think that he was really ideologically driven. I think he was driven by mental illness, and there was a pretty broad consensus at the time about that. Tim McVeigh, on the other hand, never claimed mental illness, and it was never asserted to him. He claimed Christian fundamentalism and a belief that if he could force the federal government to clamp down in a really, really harsh way, then all the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant gun owners in America would rise up against the government and everything would be great. Tim in Pomona, California. Hey, Tim, just a half a minute or so before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Hey, thank you very much, Tom. I was wondering, though, your last guest, I guess her name is Chris, is, mm-hmm. I'm assuming that she's naive because according to CNN and then according to the AP wire, 7 of the 19 hijackers were alive when the attack happened on 9/11.
I'm sorry?
7 of the 19 hijackers were alive.
After 9/11?
Yeah.
And you're talking about the reports on, where are these names? Yeah, the question about who they were and if they were. There's a million questions like that that have not been answered. A bigger point is, 14 of them were Saudis, whether they were alive or not. I mean, our good friends, Saudi Arabia, and I have some concerns about that, too. But, Tim, you're right. There's these huge gaps in the record of what happened on 9/11. And, frankly, I'm even more interested in what happened between the time that Sandy Berger and Al Gore and Bill Clinton told Condi Rice, George W. Bush, and Dick Cheney that they needed to look out for bin Laden, in January. And September, when Bush had been warned over 40 times and did nothing. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Like me and you, I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal,
he's a liberal,
I'm a liberal,
unforgivable,
I'm a liberal,
he's a liberal,
I'm a liberal,
he's your typical liberal.
And welcome back. It's a place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a good national health care plan. That would be a great start. And clean elections. How about clean elections? Where every vote gets counted and can be verified on a paper ballot. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. God, you want so much.
What's that? Yes, we just like to have what the rest of the industrialized world has. That's all. John Edwards, Politico.com, apparently one of their reporters, based on a single source, broke the story about an hour before John Edwards gave his speech that Edwards was pulling out of the race. That was picked up by CNN. I picked it up off CNN, and I said it on the air during the first 15 minutes of my program before John Edwards came on the air. We played a little bit of his press conference when he was talking about his wife's cancer. And it turns out that he's not pulling out of the race, that his wife's cancer is something that can be managed with low-level chemotherapy, which will allow her to accompany him on the campaign trail, and she wants him to become president of the United States.
Right, she does. She's a vigorous and courageous woman, and she does want him to become president of the United States, and if she has to take time off, she'll do exactly that. She may not be able to go off and do that much campaigning on her own, as a lot of wives do, but she'll do exactly what she can. And the Politico got it completely wrong. That's the danger of going with a single source.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, my danger in quoting CNN, I guess.
My danger also. I didn't quote them, but only because I didn't happen to be on the air at that time. Otherwise, I probably would have done. And I can tell you that the conventional wisdom in Washington this morning, just talking to people at the Washington Press Corps and around town, was that, well, he's going to pull out.
Right. And which, you know, I am on the one hand, were he to pull out, I was, you know, my take on it was, this is a man who's putting his family first. He really is who he says he is. You know, he really is the decent human being that we've all thought he was all along. And you certainly get a sense of that, you know, from John Edwards. And I still think that, even if he's not pulling out, because it's what his wife wants him to do, and also because the type of chemotherapy and that she's going to be going through is basically palliative. You know, they're trying to stop the growth of this cancer rather than kill it off, because
which they apparently cannot do.
Yeah, apparently it can't be killed off, and they just can't go in and take out bones, and you know, that's pretty scary stuff, frankly. And but you know, I don't want to emphasize the negative. Let's hope that Elizabeth Edwards can make it through to a ripe old age.
I thought she looked
intact.
Fabulous.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought she looked great. I mean, she looked stunning.
Yes. So what is the latest? And so we all say, you know, let's keep John and Elizabeth Edwards in our prayers and wish them the best, and go over to johnedwards.com and toss a few campaign dollars their way. What else is going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, of course, the Senate Judiciary Committee has voted to authorize subpoenas. That doesn't mean they're issuing subpoenas, as we keep pointing out the difference, and Tony Snow keeps pointing out the difference to us. But they have voted to authorize subpoenas, so they can now issue subpoenas in the case of the U.S. attorneys. There was a good bit of discussion both in this morning's briefing and in the gaggle earlier about the oath and the transcript, and these are the two big issues for the press corps, because really it is just quite bizarre that they won't allow a transcript and they won't take the oath. And I asked the question, I didn't really get a satisfactory reply, but you won't be surprised at that, which was, okay, you say you don't want the spectacle of Democrats running around brandishing the transcript in front of the cameras. That's going to be a public spectacle. But how is it possibly a public spectacle if you have someone taking the oath behind closed doors?
Mm-hmm.
How is
and
they
that won't do, they, they're not willing to do that either.
No, they're and, not willing
and,
to do
and Congress is perfectly willing to interrogate these people under oath behind closed doors, particularly if it is going to involve national security issues. They would have to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, Victoria, I've read several press reports today that Kyle Sampson, the assistant, the number two guy to Alberto Gonzalez, who is kind of being set up as the fall guy, or at least, you know, I think perhaps in his mind, he's being set up for the fall guy for all this. That he,
Kyle, yeah, Sampson.
That's right. Scooter Sampson here. That he may voluntarily testify before Congress next Thursday. Is that his idea? Is it Congress's idea? Is this a deal? Is this part of throwing Kyle to the lions? Or is this Kyle saying, I'm not going to take this anymore and I'm going to turn on these guys?
Well, that's not clear to me yet. My understanding is that Congress wants to talk to him. My understanding also is that he's quite keen at this point to talk to Congress. But who is keener? That I'm not clear about at all.
Or for what reason?
Or for what reason. I don't know what his motives are. I think he may feel that he was pushed out.
I think we have to remember what happened when John Dean testified before Congress. He was, you know, the lawyer to Nixon. Kyle Sampson, or the counselor to Nixon, he was the lawyer, but the counselor. And Kyle Sampson was the counselor to Gonzalez. And is he going to be this generation's John Dean?
At the moment, I would say probably not. He hasn't given any indication of that, at least not publicly. At the moment, we could probably expect him still to be covering his butt. But you just can't tell. And if anybody knows the secrets of what went on, if there are indeed secrets, it's Kyle Sampson.
Yeah, and that's what happened with John Dean right up until the moment of his testimony. Everybody assumed he was going to come in and stonewall. And then he just spilled this stuff out, and it was just suddenly screaming national headlines.
And we have no idea what he's going to do. I can assure you that Talk Radio News Service will be represented at the hearing, probably by moi.
Great.
I can miss that one.
So we will be represented at the hearings by you.
Oh, yeah.
that's great. All righty, Victoria Jones. And just a couple of seconds here. Any other things that we need to know about out of Washington, D.C. today?
Well... The supplemental, that's all.
The Iraq supplemental. They have not had a vote on it yet, have they?
They've not had a vote on it, and it's all a bit of a mess.
Yeah, because Pelosi doesn't think she can get her 218 votes?
212 votes is what she needs, yes.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain, on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. The radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America, the Fed met yesterday, the Federal Reserve Board, and this is from a story in... it's the Financial Times of London. And the Federal Reserve said on Wednesday it remained focused on inflation rather than growth, but qualified its bias toward tightening monetary policy, sparking a rally in stocks and bonds. What does that mean? What that means is that the Fed basically said, we're concerned with inflation, and therefore we are willing to, in the future, entertain the possibility of raising interest rates. What they're doing is they're setting up for their next meeting the expectation that they will raise rates, probably by another quarter point. Within an hour of the statement, the dollar had slipped to its lowest level against the euro in 2 years. Now, why would that happen? Well, if you have inflation, what that means is that your currency is becoming worth less. If you have monster inflation, it means your currency is becoming worthless. And the Fed future funds market price in a near even chance the first rate will come in June with 2 quarter-point cuts by year end. That's what the futures market is predicting. In other words, people who bet on this, they buy futures contracts. It looks like that's what everybody's expecting. The statement said from the Federal Funds Committee, the committee's predominant policy concern remains the risk that inflation will fail to moderate as expected. Now, the danger here is that if the Fed raises interest rates any further, that it's going to wipe out the housing market in the United States. And the housing market is the thing that has been, driving the consumer demand in the United States, which has been keeping the economy afloat. People have been basically borrowing from their homes. They've been using their homes as ATMs. This is why last year we had, for the first time since 1932, since the Great Depression, last year we had a net negative savings rate of 0.2%. People spent more money than they received nationwide. And there's a lot of people saving money, so that means that there are a lot of people going into debt. It's one of the reasons why household debt is at an all-time high in the United States. People say, well, the economy is better than it's ever been. Look at you go out on the street. Look at all these people driving their cars. Yeah, most of those cars these days are being leased, not bought. And the ones that are being bought on long-term loans. In other words, they don't own their cars. And, oh, look at all these houses everybody owns. Yeah, and most of those houses have very little equity. People don't own them. The banks own them. And so, where's our economy going? How is this all going to shake out? What is going to be the consequence of this? Well, there's that. And then you combine that with this article on the front page of today's money section in USA Today. This is really interesting. Which is more American? And they show a Chevy. A Chevy HHR and a Toyota Sienna. Which is more American? Well, the Chevy HHR, 59% of its content is made outside the United States or Canada. Apparently, Canada is also considered America. I realize we're all on the North American continent, and arguably anybody in North, Central, or South America could call themselves an American. But if you go to Canada and say, I'm from the United States, they say, oh, you're an American. If you go to Mexico and say, I'm from the United States, they say, oh, you're an American. So, you know, and we call ourselves Americans. It's I realize it's, you know, technically, factually inaccurate, but nonetheless. But for USA Today, they're talking about U.S. and Canada, which seems like an interesting juxtaposition. But in any case, the Chevy, 59% of their parts are made outside the U.S., and it's assembled in Mexico. The Toyota Sienna, 85% of their content is made inside the U.S. or Canada, and it's assembled in Indiana. Which is the American car? Well, here's the second question. The profits from the sale of the Chevrolet go to what country, by and large? You go to Chevrolet, it's a U.S. company. So they stay in the United States to the extent that, you know, profit distributions and stockholders and whatnot live in the United States. Who owns Toyota? It's a Japanese company. So the profits are going to Japan. And when they manufacture the Chevy in Mexico, where did the profit? This is, you know, it's the, Michael Moore's, you know, talking to Roger, his original movie, trying to track down Roger Smith of General Motors and talk to him about, you know, he closed all these plants in Flint, Michigan, and then opened all these factories in Mexico. Well, they're still making the cars down there. This is the face of globalization. And when you have globalization at the same time that you have this massive fiscal irresponsibility that the Bush administration is engaging in, borrowing like crazy, you end up with these absolutely bizarre numbers that, frankly, I think should give us all pause. If you think free trade is a great thing. Back in if we look back in 1995, the foreign ownership in 1995, you know, we were already well into the free trade era. I mean, you know, this all started with Reagan and Bush Sr., and then, you know, Bill Clinton really kicked the doors open with NAFTA and GATT and all that. But in 95, we were well into it. 1/8 of the total household net wealth of America was owned by foreign companies and foreign persons. Basically, 1/8 of the equivalent of 1/8 of our collective wealth. Businesses in the United States. It's now 1/4. This from economyandcrisis.org. Based on recently released figures from the U.S. Department of Commerce, as of the year end of the year 2005, now it takes a year or so to compile these figures, so this is as of the end of 2005, the rest of the world owned $2.7 trillion more of the U.S. than the U.S. owned of the rest of the world. This is an increase of $2.2 trillion over just the past 10 years. Foreign interests owned at least $12 trillion of U.S. interests. That's roughly 1/4 of the total household net wealth of this country. In the 10 years preceding NAFTA, the total for the 10 years of our trade deficit was $900 billion. Now we're hitting $900 billion a year. In the 10 years following NAFTA, it's been $3 trillion. Foreign acquisitions of U.S. companies in the 10 years after NAFTA totaled $1.2 trillion. Now, if you're going numb on all these numbers, let me just lay it out really simply. The way that we've been running this country, between global free trade and let's inflate our currency like crazy because we're borrowing like crazy in order to have wars like Vietnam and wars like Iraq, and Reagan, you know, handing out, basically giving birth to the modern the newest version of the modern military-industrial complex by transferring $1 trillion of borrowed money to his good buddies, Cap Schultz and Mr. Weinberger, or Caspar Weinberger and Mr. Schultz, having come out of the, you know, arguably out of that industry as it was. They both worked for Bechtel, the president and vice president, as I recall, respectively. That what we have now is, you know, it's sort of like you own a house. And you say, well, you know, it's you know, I'm not making as much money as I need to as I want to spend, so I'll sell off the driveway to the guy down the street. And then I'll rent it back from him. And then you still need some more money and say, well, I'll sell off the front yard to you know, the guy in the next state, and I'll rent it back from him. Or maybe I'll just sell it off to him. See, I mean, that's the difference between the debt and the actual acquisition. So we're at a situation now where basically one quarter of our house, you know, our front yard, our driveway, our front door, and the living room are owned by people in other countries or companies in other countries. A quarter of our house is owned by them. And if you listen to Mr. Walker, the comptroller of the currency of the United States, David Walker, virtually the entire rest of our house is fully mortgaged up to our eyeballs. In other words, we for all practical purposes, don't own it anymore. I mean, we have this massive debt now. The official debt is approaching $9 trillion, but the real debt, when you actually look at the real debt, particularly including things that we will owe in the future versus projected revenue in the future because of the Bush tax cuts, the real debt is that, you know, we're wiped out. We've borrowed several times what our house is worth. Now, how, if you're in that kind of a situation, can you say that you're the master of your own destiny at all, particularly when the guy down the street who owns your house comes to you and says, you know, I don't think I'm going to rent this house to you anymore. I'm just going to take it. That's the situation we found ourselves in. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the radio support group up by and for we the people of the United States of America, of North America, of planet Earth, we the people of all living things on this planet. Here, let me just extend this metaphor a little farther just to try and lay this out and make it so clear. I mean, here we have, you know, the Fed is talking about raising interest rates. Again, the possibility of raising interest rates. Why would they do that? Because of inflation. How does inflation happen? Back to our metaphor of our house. You owned a house, and then you start living beyond your means. And you're selling off pieces of your house. You've sold off a quarter of your house to various people around you. And you've borrowed against the other three quarters that's left. And now you're totally tapped out. And this is the, and keep in mind, before 1981, when Jimmy Carter was president, when Dwight Eisenhower was president, when Jack Kennedy was president, going all the way back, before 1981, the United States was the largest exporter of finished goods in the world. We were the world's manufacturing floor, or one of the major ones. And we were the largest importer of raw materials in the world. We brought in iron ore. We shipped out finished steel products like cars. We brought in rare earth minerals, and we shipped out transistors. We brought in, I mean, you just fill in the blanks. We imported leather, and we shipped out shoes. We imported cotton, and we shipped out clothing. We were the largest exporter to the world of finished goods, and we were the largest importer of raw materials. In the 26 years since Reagan changed all that, since the Reagan Revolution, since the conservative revolution, we have completely reversed that position. We are now the world's largest importer of finished goods. We're the largest consumer in the world. Remember the house that we're selling off pieces of it to buy stuff, and we're borrowing against pieces of it to buy stuff? And we're the largest exporter of raw materials. The rest of the world is mining us. And more than half of our total mining capacity in the United States, the uranium ore under the ground, the gold ore under the ground, the silver, is owned by foreign companies and foreign individuals. They are mining from the United States and shipping ore overseas and shipping back to us computers. Now, just to extend this, to explain inflation, imagine that you've done this. You've sold off your front yard, your backyard, your driveway, and the living room and front door of your house and the front porch. You sold that off the foreigners own a quarter of your house. They own a quarter of our country right now. And you have mortgaged the entire rest of your house. You have taken out a mortgage. You've borrowed money equal to the rest of your house. Now what do? You want to keep living. Well, you pull out your checkbook and you say, well, I'd still like to buy some cool stuff from you guys that you're making, because I'm not making cool stuff here anymore. I'd still like to buy some cool stuff from you. Will you take a check? And they say, sure. And so you write them a check for X, you know, say $100,000. And the country or company or person who receives your check says, hey, I got a check here from Joe worth $100,000. And they give it to somebody else, and the check starts moving around. People start exchanging the check from person to person and exchanging it for goods and services. You know, somebody buys some oil with it, and then they use it to give to somebody else to buy some, you know, have a building built. And then they use the guy who builds the building uses it. And it's moving from country to country, from person to person, until finally somebody says, maybe we ought to check and find out if there's actually $100,000 in this guy's bank. And they go back to the banker, and the banker says, no, there's not $100,000 worth of actual real value. That is to say, if you want to exchange that check for what used to be $100,000 worth of oil or gold or anything else, back when the check was originally written, we're only going to give you $80,000 worth now. Because $96,000 worth now. Because the value of the check has decreased by 4%. That's called 4% inflation. And, you know, writing checks for money you don't have and then passing them around the world and then eventually the world saying, you know, I don't think you've got all this much. At the same time that the net worth of your home, let's say, is starting to decline, because now you're having to sell off. Oh, okay, let's sell off the sink. Let's pull out the dishwasher and sell that off. Let's sell off the stove. As you're selling off pieces of your house, the value of your house is starting to decline. And so now the lenders are looking at you going, you know, you owe $200,000 on this house, but we don't think the house is worth that anymore. You say, well, let me write you a check. This is the game that this government has been playing since 1980 in the belief that somehow everything will work out because the world is flat now. Just ask Tom Friedman. And global free trade is going to solve all our problems. Just ask Bill Clinton. And, you know, if you let the corporations make all the decisions and get government out of the business of doing things for people, everything will work. We shouldn't have government regulation. We shouldn't have government protecting the people. After all, that's messy in the marketplace. Just ask Ronald Reagan or any of today's conservatives. And that's what has been brought to us today. This is the disaster that we are facing. We still can do something about. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America and frankly, once again, becoming a beacon of democracy for the planet. Tom Hartman with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Our phone number, 1-866-303-2270. Our live chat room at tomhartman.com if you want to drop in and say hi. I realize some programs do blogs, some get emails while they're live on the air. I hang out in the chat room. It's actual live interactive. You can say hi, and I can say hi, and we can talk and what like that. So, anyhow, Mark in Arcata, California. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program. Mark? Hello, Mark? No, Mark. Okay, let's go to Jeff in Los Altos, California. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. Interesting topic about inflation. I'm your occasional libertarian caller, and I've read Milton Friedman's Free to Choose and a little couple of his other writings. His whole theory about he's also the guy who brought us the Federal Reserve System. I don't know how many listeners know that.
No, the Federal Reserve System was put into place in 1913, long before Milton Friedman was around.
Didn't he have a hand in that?
No.
Oh.
No. Friedman,
all right.
You know, the Chicago School was really, largely an invention of the 1960s and 70s. It was, in large part, Friedman and Frederick von Hayek. And, all these guys who thought that you could just reduce everything to numbers essentially humanity could be diminished and reduced to numbers. And if everybody operated in their own self-interest, it would create a paradise. But the only problem with it is that it requires everybody to be paranoid and everybody to assume that everybody else is out to get them. And that might be true of the guy who came up with the original game theory, the guy that they made that movie The Beautiful Mind out of, who was a paranoid schizophrenic. But it's not true of most of us.
Well, anyway, I have to look up that point about the Federal Reserve stuff, I guess. I guess I was
wrong. Yeah, 1913, Federal Reserve Act.
All right. Well, the point I wanted to make, though, is that I do know this about, Milton Friedman was very interested in inflation. He had a pretty simple sort of way of looking at it. Simply, inflation is the government printing too much money. It's just an oversupply of money.
Yeah, that was my point. It's writing a check for more money than you have.
Yeah, I've been worried actually for past several years with all the enormous amount of borrowing that our government has done. Is simply we're just injecting a lot of money that we simply don't have, that didn't exist before, into the system with all the military stuff and contracting stuff and faith-based this and. Just it's boggling, and I think we're going to have to pay the piper at some point. And
yeah, well, here's how it worked out in Germany. After World War One, the European countries were so devastated by World War One, and they looked at the Germans and they said, if you guys, if only you hadn't had that mutual. I mean, there was a series of mutual protection contracts, essentially treaties, that from the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand led to Germany's involvement in the war. But Germany was particularly pernicious in that war. And so after the Treaty of Versailles, Germany had to repay the rest of the European countries to rebuild their countries. And the reparations were denominated in Deutschmarks. So they said, yep. To Germany, okay, you've got to repay us. I don't remember what the number was. It's been 30 years since I read this stuff. But let's say it's $100 billion. You've got to repay us 100 billion Deutschmarks.
Yep.
And you could buy one loaf of bread with one Deutschmark, let's say. Actually, it was the Deutschmark had more value than that in 1918, but let's say that that's what it was. And so Germany says, okay, fine. There's no way. We'll be taxing ourselves to death for the next 50 years to repay the Treaty of Versailles. There's no way we can do it with the Deutschmark valued where it is. But because you said you wanted to be repaid in Deutschmarks, no problem. We'll just run the printing presses and flood the market with Deutschmarks. And they did. What they did was they reduced the value of the Deutschmark down to the point where it took a billion Deutschmarks to buy a loaf of bread, and they paid off that $100 billion in about 4 years. I mean, it was just no problem at all, right? And who are the victims? The people of Germany. And that's, that hyperinflation arguably led to the rise of Hitler. And that's what Bush is doing right now. He stopped publishing M3, which is the measure of the extent to which the amount of money in circulation exceeds the how much there should be, the total value of all goods and services in the United States, all the assets of the country. So nobody knows, but everybody's trying to guess, how hard are the printing presses running? And I'm betting that the only way that they can pay off this debt that Reagan and Bush brought to us, and those two presidents are responsible for well over half of the total federal debt, just those two guys. And how can we pay this back? Well, I don't think we can. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be painful. And they don't want to do the pain, so what they're going to do is inflate their way out of it, and they won't take credit for the inflation, or they won't get blamed for the credit, or for the inflation. They'll blame everybody else in sight, and basically, the average person with a mortgage, the average person with credit, anybody who owes money in any kind of a variable instrument, from an adjustable rate mortgage to a credit card, is going to be the person who gets screwed really, really badly. And the people who own those debt instruments, they'll be able to say, hey, if the inflation rate is 30%, you pay me 35%. I mean, they'll always be ahead of the game. But the rest of us are going to get stuck with it. You're absolutely right, Jeff. And good point. Thank you for the call. Benjamin in Claremont, California. Hey, Benjamin, what's up?
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question. Is the Federal Reserve a private organization fronting as a federal organization, and is it being run by the Council of Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission?
The answer to one is yes, and the answer to two is no. The Federal Reserve is a federally chartered private corporation. There's very few of those because the word corporation doesn't appear in our Constitution. Amtrak is another one. Fannie Mae originally was one. But it is owned by its member banks. If you look, for example, when I lived in Vermont, our bank was the Chittenden Bank that we had, you know, that we did banked with. And I remember they were actually selling stock in Chittenden Bank, and they approached all their depositors and said, hey, you want to buy some stock in the bank? We'll sell you. And we are a Federal Reserve Bank, so you're buying stock actually in the bank of the Chittenden Bank. You're also buying stock in the bank that owns a piece of the Bank of Boston, the First Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, the First Federal Reserve District of Boston. And that bank in Boston owns 1/12 of the Fed. So the Fed is owned by the 12 Federal Reserve banks, and those banks are owned by smaller local banks, which are owned by local stockholders. What that has to do with the Trilateral Commission and all that sort of thing, you know, virtually nothing, other than the fact that it may be the same people who are large stockholders in the banks. And then you can, you know, take that back into conspiracy theory if you want. Mark in Maine. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
Have you read the book Perfectly Legal? I'm sure you have. By David K. Johnston?
I know I haven't. I know of it, but I may even have it, but I haven't. I can't tell you that I've sat down and read every word in it, no.
It's a good book. Anyways, I work in the mortgage industry, and I love this show because I've been seeing it for the last, 5-10 years, people just borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. And the problem is now that we're on the decline, these people that own these houses up to 100% of the finance value, the appraised values are now going down, and so they're stuck.
Right.
And also, you got the ARM products that are going to be coming due, and a lot of those were interest only. So there's going to be a payment shock that you've never seen in your life coming up here. It's happening now.
Well, it's happening right now. This is why, you know, I'm forgetting the name of the company, but there's one company that's already stopped doing loans and might be on the verge of bankruptcy, and there may be more coming, and this could make the SNL disaster look like a picnic.
I know, and you know, it reminds me of the story, the old Bible story of Moses going up and then his people building the golden calf. And I think that we lost our souls when Reagan came into office. And I'm not blaming him for everything, but it just seems like we focused so much on the gold cards and everything. We didn't find true happiness within ourselves. We just had to buy.
And we threw away a lot of traditional American values. I mean, during the Eisenhower administration, and I use that as an example because he was a Republican, and the Republicans controlled Congress for much of the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah.
You had values in the United States that it wasn't appropriate for a CEO to take more than 30 times what his lowest paid employee took. In fact, in the civil service system, the top civil servant, this is the president, couldn't make more than 20 times what a janitor in a Veterans Administration building made. In most universities, it was a 20-to-1 ratio.
Yeah,
I mean, we just all believed that to be how it should be.
Yeah, and the investment gap right now that's going on, I mean, China's buying all the properties either in the United States or overseas. And, I mean, what we want is we want to have leverage in other countries if we want to, promote democracy. And
or at least equality.
If we're going to be owned by everyone, then it's certainly not going to give us the leverage that we need.
Yeah, or let's at least have equality. I mean, you could argue that, you know, prior to 1980, we owned too much of the rest of the world. And that's why you had Nicaragua going down in flames, you know, because of the excesses of the banana companies. You know, there's a reason for the phrase banana republic, and not just obviously the banana companies.
It's such a breath of fresh air, Tom. It's such a great show.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. Thank you for your kind words. But that's, you know, that Mark really, you know, put his finger on it. And this is something that, frankly, I think all of us need to be very, very concerned about is the direction that this country is going economically. And we're going that way because when Reagan came in, there was a fundamental recalibration of what our values are. And we went from the values of community that this country was founded on and had sustained us for almost 200 years. We went from that set of values, or actually over 200 years if you count 1776 as the starting point. For over 200 years, we went from the value of community to the value of the individual. From the value of we're all in this together and the chain is only as weak as, or is only, yeah, it's only as strong as its weakest link, to we're all Davy Crockett's here. We're all, you know, and everybody needs to be suspicious of everybody else, and everybody needs to be looking to get advantage over everybody else. And that theory that came out of the Chicago School of Economics, and Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek and all of these guys who promoted what became Reaganism, what has become modern conservatism, have led us to this brink that we're at, and we need to pull back from it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Tell
me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back just 'cause you're half insane.
Oh, tell me, George.
Freak judges, $200 million. Grudges, yes, wars cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
Andy. And apparently he is, but the rest of us aren't, and we really need to take back this country and do run it right. I mean, just fiscally reasonable. For example, Reagan, he submitted 8 budgets. Out of those 8 budgets that Ronald Reagan submitted, 7 of them were cut by the Democratic Congress. He never, ever submitted a balanced budget to Congress. Why? Because he believed that, you know, well, as Dick Cheney said, Reagan showed that deficits don't matter. In fact, he tripled the national debt. So, anyhow, enough ranting about that, I suppose. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jeff in Orange County. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Well, perfect timing on your diatribe there. Last hour when you were talking to Chris Winston and you mentioned that that Reagan had run up the debt, as you just mentioned now, she said, oh, well, it was Congress that spent the money. You know, the Congress always spends the money. And
right.
Republicans always want to say that, but what they also crow about is Reagan cut taxes. Well, you know, only Congress can cut taxes. Reagan can't do it. The president can't do it.
Yeah.
It's the Congress that does it. So you can't take credit on the one side for something that Congress does and then on the other side say, oh, it was Congress that spent the money.
Yeah, good point. Good point. And Congress actually cut 7 out of 8 of Reagan's budgets, and they were crazy to have gone along with his tax cuts, but they did, and all the more the shame. Jeff, thanks for the call. Mike in Great Neck, New York.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike.
Hi.
You want to disagree with me?
I disagree with you in terms of you keep you know, this business about the movement of factories and trade out of the United States is something that would have happened anyway.
It didn't for over 200 years because we had tariffs in place to protect us from this. There are 6 billion
right.
people in the world. Half of them make less than $2 a day. They're all willing to work for us.
Right.
How do you think you're gonna have any kind of decent income against that?
The point is the only way you're gonna 20% of the people in the world have 60% of the world's GDP. It's divided among countries, the West and Japan. And if you were a day laborer, if you were a day laborer born in the United States 20 years ago, you probably lived better than a doctor in India. Now, those things are being equalized now. So that the 20% of the world that will exploit the 80% for the 60% of the world's goods will be spread throughout all the countries.
Yeah,
now,
so you're assuming, first of all, you know, Mike, you're assuming that there needs to be some sort of distribution of the world's wealth that is absolutely egalitarian and equal. And I would suggest to you that if you try and do that, which is what, you know, global free trade is trying to do, this immediate, you know, just let's, you know, thin the entire thing out, that what you're going to have are massive dislocations and frankly, it's going to be very destructive. Free trade didn't help Mexico. It increased poverty in Mexico. What it does is it helps the billionaires tremendously. The billionaires become multi-billionaires. The billionaires become multi-millionaires. You get an increased concentration of wealth in a small number of hands. Yes, there are some countries that are growing. India and China, for example, industrializing. Is that necessarily a good thing at the expense of the United States? From the viewpoint of the United States, I'd say no. From the viewpoint of China, sure. But, you know, why not have China industrialize based on their own internal markets? And frankly, that's the direction they're going. And when they get there, they're going to say goodbye to us. And then we're going to be in big trouble because we basically did it and then handed it all off to them. I mean, it's just, I'm sorry, I don't buy it. It's not the way to go. Michael in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, I love listening to you. It's just great brain talk. But I wanted to mention something about Bush, and then I wanted to mention something about what you said about Hitler and the Treaty of Versailles. Now, first of all, for like 6 years, I've been screaming at people and saying that Bush is trying to bankrupt the country because if you can pay somebody the same amount of money but depress the dollar, then you're actually paying them less in comparison to the world market, and the big companies of the world are making more money. If you
That's
can
right.
follow me on that.
Welcome to the wonderful world of inflation. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to say about the Treaty of Versailles. Now, I'm sure you read Hitler, A Study in Tyranny.
No, but I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Okay, Hitler, A Study in Tyranny by, I believe his name was Bullock. He died in 1999. I'd love to have known what he thought of Bush at this point. That was the primary reason why Hitler came to power, because the Treaty of Versailles, he knew it was killing the country.
That's what I said.
Yeah, yeah. But you said
and it was the debt that Germany was laden with. And frankly, it was stupid of the Axis powers or the Allied powers to say, you know, that they were going to, I don't think they were called that then, but, you know, basically the rest of Europe and America to say that they were going to laden Germany with that much debt over that short a period of time, because really the only option that the Hindenburg government had, as I recall, the Weimar Republic had, was to try and inflate their way out of it.
Most definitely.
And which just, you know, devastated the average person and paved the way for a demagogue. And I think you're right. If we continue down that road here in the United States, we could be setting up the same thing here. It wouldn't be a good thing. That's why we need to wake people up and change it. Coming up tomorrow, Friday, Senator Bernie Sanders, our first hour, taking your calls as he does every Friday at noon Eastern Time in our Brunch with Bernie segment. Jan Crawford is dropping by in her book, Supreme Conflict, the inside story of struggle for control of the U.S. Supreme Court, that and more, and your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.